Today's speaker is Dr. Latif Olubade Badru. Dr. Badru received a PhD in sociology with specializations in international economic development as well as economic sociology from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, following his undergraduate work at the City University of London and his earning of a master's from the London School of Economics. Before coming to UMBC, he taught in Nigeria and in the United States at Albion College, Rowan University, and the University of Louisville. He has published 4 books, with the 5th in the works, and many scholarly articles. He has served as an expert witness in immigration cases involving deportation and asylum in federal courts, and is involved with a program to help capable students pay high school fees in West Africa. And he is chair of the Board of Trustees for the International Agency for Refugee Movement. Dr. Badru will be addressing us today, and his topic is African Migration to the U.S. in Recent Times.
Thank you for the introduction. I was so delighted for your introduction. When I left New York this morning, to come to Baltimore, I asked my daughter, and I said, I'm going to speak at the Baltimore Ethical Society. And I say, what advice do you have for me? And she said, don't make any jokes. And I said, why? And she said that it usually takes about 2 weeks to appreciate my jokes. So I'm not going to make any joke this morning. Okay. When I was asked by Dr. Meskin, my colleague there, to speak here, I said, well, what can I speak about? He said, talk about anything. And I said, okay, I will talk about the immigration to the U.S. And we had a discussion at the beginning of my talk with him. He said he was looking at the Internet, and the Internet said there were 4 waves of African immigration to the U.S. Say 4 waves. Okay, yeah. He said, why? I said, well, there were Africans in the New World before 1619. And these were free Africans. They were not slaves. There were Africans in Portugal in the 15th century, and they were not slaves. Most of these Africans who came on the boat as artisans or laborers, and they ended up in the New World. The second wave of immigration is what you call the slavery. Slavery, the bringing up the African Americans as slaves to the New World, which began in 1619, which is a year before the Mayflower. You understand what I mean by the Mayflower? And slavery continued until 1840. Even though the British abolished slavery in their domains, in their colonies, by as early as 1803. The third wave of immigration, which I identify as pre-war migration to the New World, this was between 1933 and 1945. A lot of Africans fought during the Second World War. Many of them were brought to Europe. Many of them fought in North Africa, and also in the Far East. This is the most crucial period for Africa because after the Second World War, I think it was President Trudeau who approached Truman, one of the American president, immediately after the war, and he signed what they call the Atlantic Charter. Which basically told Europeans that you have to decolonize within the next 10 years, because it's a contradiction for you to practice democracy in your countries, and then you still have these colonies who are still being ruled basically under a slavery system. So after 1933, a lot of Africans began to come to the US and also to Europe. And these people were later to become the nationalist leaders after 1955. One of the most important of these people is Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe, who came from Nigeria, and he eventually became the first president of Nigeria in 1960, after Nigeria became independent. Dr. Azikiwe, he went to Lincoln University and actually played football. I think he played football in 1935 or 1936. He was a big man, tall. After Lincoln, he also went to Temple and got his PhD before coming back to Nigeria. He wasn't actually allowed to come back to Nigeria because of his anti-British activities in the U.S. So he went to Ghana to start a newspaper, which is called the West African Post. And that West African Post became the platform for anti-British movement in West Africa. Another nationalist that came to the U.S., many of them were drawn here because of the Lincolnian idea of freedom and justice, was Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Dr. Kwame Nkrumah also went to Temple University, and he became familiar with a lot of African Americans who were part of the civil rights movement, who were part of the liberation movement. And one of them was Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. I'm sure you all know Dr. Du Bois. And Dr. Du Bois was very, very connected to the African liberation struggle, especially after the Manchester Conference in 1945. This is the first, they told the Pan-African Congress in 1945. It was in Manchester. At the conference, you have African leaders like Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, Dr. Azikiwe, Jomo Kenyatta, Wilmot Blyden, who was a Liberian, whose parents were shipped back to Liberia in 1847, and then later came back to the U.S. and became a strong advocate of African independence. So at the 1945 Congress, they demanded the decolonization of Africa within the next 5 years. The British were very, very opposed to this idea. They believed the colony is going to be part of Commonwealth of Great Britain. The French were also very opposed to this idea, especially the French concept of Alliance Francaise. They see the colony as part of Greater France. But after 1957, when the French were militarily defeated in Algeria, it became clear that none of these colonial powers can hold on to their territories in Africa. So what they did from 1950 to 1955 was promote massive immigration of Africans to the U.S. so that when they decolonized, these people can take over the administration of government. So that was the third wave of the fourth wave, which I would say began in 1955, from 1955 to 1960. And this will include Obama's father, which is the current president. Obama's father came to the U.S. in 1959. Some of the biography got it wrong. They say it was 1960. It wasn't 1960. He came to the U.S. in 1959 on a scholarship. The scholarship is called Tom Mboya Scholarship. Tom Mboya was a nationalist fighter, was a freedom fighter in Kenya who had fought along Jomo Kenyatta. Tom Mboya set up an organization to help African to be trained in the U.S. The contributors to this scholarship fund were African Americans who were in the entertainment industry, people like Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier. They contributed to this money. But by 1959, the scholarship fund was running out of money. So they approached Senator Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, who he eventually became the president, and said, we really need to bring these young Africans to America to be trained, especially after independence has been granted. Senator Kennedy, or President Kennedy, was so generous that he used his own family fund to fund this program. The first check he wrote was for $100,000, which was a lot of money then. It's still a lot of money today. So the reason why Kennedy was so much interested in this new wave of African immigration to the U.S. was because of the Cold War. By 1958, Russia, what you call the Soviet Union, has begun to infiltrate into Africa. And they were doing this in a way that they were offering scholarships to young Africans to go to Russia so that they can become a communist leader when they come back. So the interest of the U.S. was actually sparked by the need to prevent communism in Africa. So they gave a lot of scholarships to Africans to come to the U.S. As I said, Obama's father was one of those who came in 1959. And I will talk briefly about Obama's father. I never met him. He was a generation ahead of me. He came 10 years after I left Africa. He came in 1959 to go to the university in Honolulu. I got a degree in 1952. From there, he got a scholarship to go to Harvard to get his PhD in economics. Unfortunately, people don't know this, he never got the PhD in economics because his scholarship was withdrawn just a year before he was supposed to present his dissertation. And for too many reasons. Number one, when he got to Hawaii, he married Obama's mother, and even though he was married in Kenya, he had a wife in Kenya, He never told Obama's mother that he was married. And when he left Obama's mother in 1954, she actually filed for divorce in 1954, he went to Cambridge, to Harvard in Cambridge for the PhD. And within the first 6 months of getting to Cambridge, he met another beautiful Jewish woman by the name of Ruth Beatrice Baker. Her name is Beatrice Baker. And she fell in love with him and was wonderful love affair. At 6 months, about a year into the marriage, he was asked to leave the U.S. because his scholarship was withdrawn from him. So he went back to Kenya. When he went back to Kenya with Ruth Beatrice Baker, and they actually got married in Kenya. And he was still keeping his wife. His old wife was still there while he brought this woman to Kenya. He worked for Tommy Boyer, who was then the Minister of Finance. He worked for him as an economist, an advisor to Tommy Boyer. Unfortunately, when Boyer was assassinated in 1969, Kenyatta fired Obama's father. Because he had published two papers in 1967 and 68. The first paper he published, which was tied to African socialism and its applicability to planning in Kenya. It was a critique of the land issues in Kenya, and Jomo Kenyatta didn't like that. The following year, he published another article which he tied to problems facing our socialism. And that completely irritated Jomo Kenyatta. He fired him. He said, no, you're not going to be in my government anymore. He was able to get a job as a director of a Kenyan sanitation department. I mean, from the Ministry of Economics to the sanitation department. It was a huge humiliation. The time he was going through this crisis, he started drinking. He started drinking heavily. And he became abusive to Beatrice, which later left him and took their three children from Kenya and crossed the border to Tanzania, where he remarried and gave the name of his new husband to the three children. And between 1969 and 1980, Obama's father was involved in three separate car crashes. So he was drunk. Actually, by the time he died in 1980, they already amputated his two legs. He had no legs again. And he kept drinking and drinking and drinking. So he died in 1980. So Obama's father's life was kind of a tragedy which is born out of the colonial situation. So after Obama, you have the new waves of immigration, people like me. I left Nigeria in 1970. The reason why I left Nigeria was because I won a scholarship. I won a British Council scholarship to go to Oxford. You go to Oxford for a preparatory school. The first year you spend at Oxford, they train you how to become British. There was no academic content. There was no academic content. And I still have the mannerism in me. We were told how to hold the spoon and fork. We were told that the pillow has to be where we put our head. And we were told how to drink your tea, how to hold your saucer. We were told all of that. We were told how when you see a lady and you're sitting down, we're supposed to stand up. You take up your hat if you're wearing anything and bow down and say, "My lady." So all of these were an attempt to create new categories of leaders that will become elite once the British left the colony. It was good. But after the 1 year, you have the choice to stay at Oxford. You can either go to Barnard College, or you can choose to leave Oxford and go to another college, which was when I chose to go to London School of Economics. I went to London, University of London. And I was there in the early 70s. I think Clinton was there. The President Clinton was in England then. And the time we were in England, it turns out to be the revolutionary period in the history of Europe. Revolution in the sense you have the Vietnam War, 1968, the Tet Offensive. You also have Sorbonne, which was one of the best universities you can go in Europe, was occupied for almost 6 months. And 2 years later, London School of Economics was also occupied. This occupation also allowed African students to express themselves. And one of those groups that emerged in the 70s was the ANC, which is the African National Council Student Union. And they became so bold, and it was headed by Mbeki. Mbeki later became the president of South Africa. He had such a bad temper. He still does, though. So the second wave were people like us who were supposed to be trained in England, then go back home, and then become the leader. After I went back home in 1979, I chose to teach at the university in Nigeria, University of Port Harcourt. But within 6 years, it became impossible for me to teach in the university because of the military taking over the government. I remember when I teach in my class that the army used to send new students. These are people you've never seen before. These are new students. Even though the semester is like 3 weeks to come to an end, they would send all these young ladies. They give them a tape recorder. They put on their name, and you pull your chair to, you know, just to get closer, not knowing that you're recording yourself. So it became clear that they were arresting us. They arrested my colleague. They went to his house, and it wasn't there. And they picked up his four-year-old son was picked up. And they told his wife that if you love your son, you should submit yourself. But he never did that, so he eventually got the asylum in the U.S. So this is the type of conditions that led to immigration of Africans to the U.S., especially after the independence in 1960. Now, let me talk about the pull factors. Or before I talk about that, today you have about 940,000 Africans in the U.S., 940,000, which is about 0.2% of the U.S. population. So from 1967 to 2000, because you have the 2000 census record, the total number of Africans that came to the U.S. was between 880,000 to 940,000, which represent 3.3% of the total immigration to the U.S. It's not a whole lot of people coming. But the recent migration to the U.S. was caused by political and economic reasons. Those who came in the early 80s were political dissidents, people who were opposing the military government, people like me and people like other people who were being repressed by the military government. Then in 1984, the World Bank, I know you guys know the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, they imposed on Africa a new economic program which they call the Structural Adjustment Program. Structural Adjustment Program was a very nasty economic policy. If you are an economist, you see what I'm talking about. The Structural Adjustment Program called for severe cut in social services, reduction in wages, devaluation of national currencies, all these bad policies. What it did was to really complicate the development process in Africa. I remember when I was in Ghana in 1986, the president of Ghana, his name was Jerry Rawlings. He was a very tough man. He invited all African economists to come to Ghana to talk about the structural adjustment program. At the time, Ghana currency, which is called cedis, was only 500 cedis to one US dollar. After the implementation of the structural adjustment program in 1984 and 1985, the currency dropped to 10,000 cedis to one US dollar. Today, it's about 14,600 cedis to US dollars. And there was no corresponding rise in wages at all. I remember when I go to Ghana, I have an NGO in Ghana that provides scholarship to young girls. And when I go to the bank to change $500, I have to buy two or three bags to put the currency in it. And by the next Friday, you're ready to go and change another $500. Because it's just useless. And when you give the Ghanaians, when you give them their currency, they say they don't want it. Everybody wanted the dollar. So these economic conditions, especially from 1984 to 1995, created a new wave of African migrants in the U.S. Many of them were basically forced to flee their homelands because of these economic conditions. As I speak to you today, 86% of Africans live below $2 a day. 86% of them, including oil-rich countries like Nigeria and South Africa. They live below $2 a day. This is the World Bank data. And there are many of them who don't have it. They don't have a job. They don't have a salary. Most of the farmers who work all day long, they make like about $60 in a year. Coffee farmers. You know Starbucks? Starbucks buy coffee from Ethiopia and he pays Ethiopian farmers 36 cents on a kilo of coffee. 36 cents on a kilo of coffee. So you can imagine you can imagine the type of extreme exploitation which is going on there. And when I went to Ethiopia, I went to a factory which is run by Starbucks. And all the workers there, they were women, and they paid them 22 cents an hour. they still pay them 22 cents an hour. So meaning that in a week, they probably make like about $6 a week working for 18 hours a day. And I mean, picking coffee is not your easiest job to do. It's so boring, so monotonous, and so humiliating. So all these conditions, all these economic conditions led to the new wave, the recent wave of migration from Africa to the U.S. And again, you can talk about the pool, share about the pool. Remember, in the 1990s, late 80s and 1990s, there's a structural change in the U.S. economy, if you're observing the economic trend here. A lot of people move away from traditional discipline like medicine, engineering, and move to information sciences, the internet millionaire. And that created a lot of job opportunities in the U.S. And the U.S. began to advertise abroad that we need you, we need your talent, we need it. So they brought a whole bunch of Africans to the U.S., especially doctors who were trained back home. You go to Nashville, go to Kentucky, 40 to 48% of their doctors are African doctors. And that was because there was no American doctors, because many of them are now going to this get-rich-quick program in the internet service. They brought the Indians. They brought everybody. So you can see the push and the pull. When I was teaching in Nigeria, I was making about $800 a month before the currency devaluation. When the currency was devalued in 1985, it dropped to $80 a month. Because the time I started teaching there in 1982, the currency was like, when you bring one Nigerian naira, which is the Nigerian dollar, when you bring it to the U.S. then, you get $2. But when the structural adjustment program was implemented, it became 40 naira to one U.S. dollar. And 3 years later, it became 120 to one U.S. dollar. And now today, it's 175 Nigerian dollars to one U.S. dollar. And there was no comparable increase in wages or anything like that. So you have these young people who got their degrees, couldn't find a job. Even when you find a job, your income is not enough to support you or your family. So what do? They pack their bag and come to the U.S. thinking that it's a paradise here. I remember when I went to Ghana, I have my program in Ghana, I go every 4 months. I saw this guy, I met this guy in 1986. He had a wife, he didn't have a job. He has 2 kids. His wife was working for him. When I went back last year, he had 2 wives and 6 kids. He still didn't have a job. And he asked me that he would like to come to the U.S. I said, you want to leave? This is paradise for you. You want to come to the U.S.? If you want to come to the U.S., I can change place with you. You come to the U.S., I give you my ex-wife's phone number, you call them, and then you know what's all about to live in America. So they have these images of America as being the paradise. They get all the TVs. They get Oprah Winfrey. They got everybody. They got even the program you don't see here, they see it in Africa. They get European TV, they get Japanese TV, they get American TV. And all this programming shows Americans as millionaire, billionaires. I remember there was a guy, before I left Africa, they told him that when you come to America, as soon as you step off from the airplane, you start picking American dollar, $100. So people will go back to their village and borrow money. They borrow $1,600 to buy a ticket to come to the U.S. And they thinking that as soon as they get to the U.S., they will pick the $1,200 and send it back to the village. Since I've been here, I never pick a dollar on the street. I never picked one before. So these type of images, false images about the good life and good things in America, were drawing people to the America. And when they come here, they were in shock. The rate of murder among the Africans has been growing steadily. That was the case of a young woman in Baltimore that was decapitated by her husband. Because before she came to join him, she got the impression that this guy had a lot of money. He lived in a mansion, he had the limousine, he had this. Then he came and discovered that this guy only drive cab, drive the yellow taxi, and he wasn't making enough money. And she tried to leave him for another man. I said, oh no, you can do that. He killed her and then tied her to the tire neck with a rope and tied the rope to his SUV and started dragging her until she was decapitated. So these are the stories. Most of the stories don't make the news because perhaps maybe they were Africans or something like that. But the conditions of Africans in this country are so bad that many of them would like to go back to Africa. There's a guy in New York. I taught in New York for 7 years. I was at Stony Brook. This guy went to the police station in New York and told them that he didn't have paper to stay in the U.S. And they told me, yeah, we knew that. Because he thought by going to them, they would give him ticket to go back to Africa. They said, no, you brought yourself and you got to find your way out. A lot of Africans would like to go back to Africa, but they didn't have the means to do that. So given the conditions of the false information that they get in the U.S., these people end up here. You have from the data I quoted to you, you have a lot of undocumented Africans who are here who are not properly documented. They usually go through Europe, and then from Europe, they come to the U.S. Or they go through Latin America, and from Latin America, they come to the U.S. A lot of undocumented Africans. But they live in fear every day. So the good life that they talk about is not just, it's not what they have when they come back. Let me speak a little bit about what's going on in Africa today, and I will stop, and then you can ask me questions. Was that they... Since 1984 to 2005, which was when the World Bank data, which I'm trying to quote from, it showed clearly that the rate of mortality is actually declining in Africa. Mortality, you know, the infant mortality is actually shot up. It's 100 out of 1,000 births. Okay. And the number of women that died while giving birth is actually shot up. Like it's like every one out of every birth, the woman would probably end up dying. And at the same time, you have riches. You have a lot of rich people in Africa. I'm talking about rich people, like in Nigeria. When the last president died, President Abacha in Nigeria, when he died, and they told his wife that your husband just died, and she told them not to tell anyone. She said, just leave him there, because he died on top of two Indian prostitutes that was brought from Dubai. So the Indian prostitutes, they brought Viagra. They brought Viagra, so they say, Alaji. Alaji is the Muslim leader. Say, use one. He used one, nothing happened. Use another one, nothing happened. Use another one. So in the end, he died. So when he died and they told the wife that husband just died, said, "Leave, don't tell anyone," because he had to collect all the money in the house. So she spent hours collecting about $750 million and crossed the border to Lebanon. So you have this corruption, you have this extreme poverty, where children are dying because their parents do not have a 10 cents to buy the medicine for them. You have young girls. The reason why I started my program in 2000 was that most countries in West Africa, they sponsor all children to finish middle school. After middle school, they have to go to high school for 3 years, but your parents have to pay for them. And the school fees is about $40 a month. And your parents are not making $20 a month. So at that point, 84% of the young girls, they drop out. And they either go married or they go into prostitution. Many of them, we also work for a rich man. We call it rich people in America, big men. They work for a big man and they become sex slaves. And this is happening every day. So that's why we step in, that if you can show us that you're capable of finishing high school, but your parents don't have the money, then we will pick you up and then we'll match you with a sponsor in the U.S. And we've been doing this for the past 2005. The conditions in Africa are very desperate. People, you don't see this on TV. They're very, very desperate. The drought in Ethiopia is compounding the problem. It's compounding the problem. You in Somalia, the same problem. In Darfur, the same problem. All across Africa, the same problem. So these economic problems then create the basis for them to abandon their homes and try to come to the U.S. Every month, you get a report of Africans dying in the desert in Libya, because they have to use Libya to cross to Spain or Morocco. They were attacked by Arab militias. Many of them died of starvation while crossing the desert. They don't have no water. They didn't have the idea that they will have to trek 1,000 miles to cross to Spain. So they probably bring like about 2 or 3 bottles of water with them. So every month they pick them up. And those who went through the boat, they also crash. So the desperation is what is now pushing African migration into the U.S. So what solution do we have? I don't know. Is Africa going to be okay in the next few years? I don't think so. The economic data show clearly that economic conditions in Africa is going to decline more. It's going to worsen. It's going to worsen. Now, who's in Africa now? Not the Americans, the Chinese. The Chinese are in Africa. The Chinese will tell African government, oh, we loan you money. You don't have to go to the World Bank to go and get money. We loan you money. You have to sign a document that will take all your resources out of your country. Just say that. The last African Union meeting was held in Beijing. African Union meeting was held in Beijing. You see Chinese all over the place. In Kenya, in Ghana, in Zambia, they control most of the resources now. There's a new mineral, which is called coltan. How many people have heard about coltan before? Yeah, coltan is you can only get coltan in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC. And the mines are owned by the Chinese and the Japanese. Coltan is what you need in your laptop, your cell phone, and the night goggle. You know, the night goggle, the one the military use. That's what the coltan is for. And that's why the Democratic Republic of the Congo, they're fighting over the control of these resources, which is not even used in Africa. Africa is the only country that produce what they don't need, and then where they eat what they don't produce and produce what they don't need. It's like an economic trap. If you as a nation, you cannot produce what you consume, then you're gone. And it doesn't used to be like that. I remember when I was growing up in Africa in the 50s, we used to have plenty of food. We used to have oranges, mangoes, everything. In Africa, the trees belong to everybody. You don't have to pay for mangoes. You just see a mango there, you just go and pluck it. Belongs everywhere. But when the British came, they told us, no, you cannot produce food. For you to develop, you need to produce commodities, cash crops. and then you can use the money from the cash crop to import food. From an economic point of view, it doesn't make any sense. There was a program, I wrote a book on the World Bank. It was in 1996, I think. And I followed, there was a program in Sierra Leone. You all know Sierra Leone? It's in West Africa. Sierra Leone used to be one of the best producers of rice in the world. Rice, you know rice? Which is their staple food. They're the best producer. The World Bank said, no, we're going to give you $500 million. It's called the Agricultural Revitalization Loan. I'll give you $500, but not to grow rice. You're going to grow poppies, flowers. What do you call it? The one you give to your girlfriends?
Roses,
yeah. Africans don't give nobody roses. We don't. That's our culture. We don't give no roses. They say, okay, you grow roses, you export the roses to Germany, to Norway, to England, and then the money you get from there, you use the money to import rice from South Korea. That doesn't make any sense. So this pattern of economic trend in Africa is going to produce chaos. It's going to be more wars. Like in Nigeria, now they're bombing every day in Nigeria. Islamic radicals, they're bombing people. They're killing children. They're killing women. And that was because of the economic crisis in the continent. Thank you very much.